Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Welcome, everyone. Today we're going to talk about the exploding phenomenon of service animals and the Americans with Disabilities Act. My name is David Raisman. I'm a shareholder in the Los Angeles office of Ogletree Deacons. And my practice focuses on disability issues of all kinds, both as they arise in employment and in public accommodations.
And I'm James Paul. I go by Jim or Paul, since I have two first names. David and I are co-chairs of Ogletree Deacons Disability Access Practice Group. We both practice in various aspects of labor and employment law and disability access. But today, specifically, we're going to be talking about Americans with Disabilities Act and related state laws pertaining to service animals.
So, Jim, our listeners probably know that the ADA has different parts that are applicable to different actors. We have Title I, which applies to employers. We have Title II, which applies to public entities. We have Title III that applies to public accommodations, which are places open to the public. A lot of the action in the service animal area has been given to public accommodations, but we want to focus today first on the employment provisions and how that's changing. Let me ask you, Jim, have you been seeing the same uptick in service animals in the workplace that I've been seeing here in California?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say in the last year or two, I've seen it several times over and more compared to the last 10 or 15 years. Has now caught on with employees that, you know, they may need accommodations in the workplace, and one type of accommodation can be a service animal.
Let's talk about those service animals. Let's just deal with some basics here in the employment context. When we're dealing with service animals in public places under Title III, we're talking really about dogs and miniature horses. Do we have the same kind of limitations under Title I, the employment provisions of the ADA?
So interestingly, Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which governs the employer and employee relationship, is completely silent on service animals. It doesn't refer to them, doesn't define them, doesn't explain like Titles II and III do with regard to dogs and miniature horses, doesn't reference service animals at all. And so that might lead some people to think that service animals might not even be a proper, reasonable accommodation for an employee's disability at work. But that's not the case. The regulations and definitions that exist in Title III of the ADA pertaining to public accommodations and their customers, guests, patients, visitors, et cetera, do not limit or affect what an employee might request as a reasonable accommodation or how an employer has to respond to that request.
So for those listeners who haven't been exposed to this, give us some examples of how an animal could be a reasonable accommodation in the workplace.
So just like in the public accommodation context, if someone is visually impaired and has a seeing eye dog, or they're hearing impaired and they have, a hearing dog or animal that helps them be able to get around in society and function in daily life. Obviously, an employee who is blind or deaf or vision or hearing impaired may use a dog or an animal for the same purpose. Mobility limitations with an employee, a dog can, certainly help that and may be able to help guide or pull some type of wheelchair or other mobility device that an employee might be using. So those are the common ones and the ones that, we've seen outside the employment context. But, in the employment context itself, since, as I referred to before, we don't have any definition or limitations on the type or species of animals, nor on the types of accommodations that animals can provide in the workplace, we certainly are seeing more of the emotional support, more of the post-traumatic stress disorder support, seizure support, other types of impairments that employees might have that a dog or some other animal might be trained or might provide some type of aid or comfort to the employee. So anytime an employee requests to bring an assistive animal to the workplace, then an employer would be well advised to consider through its usual reasonable accommodation process whether or not that animal should be allowed in the workplace and what are the parameters going to be.
Is it just open season, an open game that anything can go, any kind of species? What are the basic requirements for when an animal must be required?
Yeah, well, under federal law, we don't have any guidance. Title I does not discuss, define, or explain what a service animal is. It just requires reasonable accommodations to be provided to disabled employees. So theoretically, we can think of all kinds of examples where different species, including potentially, you know, other mammals or reptiles or birds, might be used by an employee, especially in kind of the emotional support or comfort category. So we've certainly seen a lot of cats. A cat may provide emotional support or, you know, other aid to an employee with some type of mental or emotional impairment. Usually it's going to have to be something that's trainable if they are actually performing some type of physical task or sensing seizures coming on or sensing low blood sugar for diabetics. But any animal potentially, now for me, a snake would not provide emotional support, but I presume, haven't quite seen it yet, that an employee could say that their pet reptile or pet amphibian or pet bird provides emotional support to them. And we cannot rule out service animals providing emotional support in the workplace, like we can in the public accommodation context that I'm going to get to ask you questions about, David, in a couple minutes. So any request for any type of animal at least has to be received and evaluated in some manner. Maybe we'll be able to summarily reject or dismiss those, but you can't do it just on the basis that it's not a dog or miniature horse.
All right. But can you do it if the animal's dangerous or creates a danger or creates an undue hardship for an employer, like you can with the denial of other reasonable accommodations?
Absolutely. So if, you know, certainly safety is always part of the analysis for a reasonable accommodation. And so if the animal itself is either poisonous or dangerous or bites or creates some other safety issue, then that can be taken into consideration. And also if for whatever reason it prevents or it presents an undue hardship or undue burden for the employer, then that can be a basis for rejecting the specific request for an accommodation. Maybe you'll have to look at other alternatives or other options, but the ADA is not going to require dangerous or burdensome or troublesome animals in the workplace.
Let me get your thoughts on something that I'm starting to see a little bit of a backlash where fellow employees to the accommodated employee with a service animal at the workplace complain about the animal's odor or their allergies to their animal or their fear of the animal. What about that? How do we think about that as lawyers and the undue
hardship? Well, absolutely. So in that situation, it's going to come down to, are we going to be able to separate, segregate, or otherwise protect, you know, both employees, so to speak, in the sense that, you know, the employee with the animal, can they use and get whatever assistance from their animal, either in, you know, a separated area or away from employees that are going to, you know, have problems or issues, either because of allergies or fears or, you know, otherwise performing their work operations and their work tasks with that animal being there. So if, for instance, there is just no possible way to separate the employees or to separate the animal from problematic areas or other employees that can't work alongside or near that animal, then that would be a basis for denying that request. But you have to explore other options, including, like I said, you know, moving or transferring the employee to a different area so that you don't have that interaction or that problem with the animal being in proximity to other employees or otherwise interfering with operations.
And we've done that, and sometimes where there's team meetings, let's say, where everyone needs to attend, we've spoken to the employee who needs the service animal and said, can you be without the service animal for the period of this meeting, just part of the interactive process? And where the employee's agreeable to that and it makes sense, they're willing to do that. And we set up a kennel in a different part and they attend the meeting with their coworkers who might be allergic or afraid. And that's a way of accommodating all parties in the workplace.
Absolutely. And there's certainly an overlap with working remotely here too, because to the extent that employees, even outside of the service animal context, if an employee can work remotely or call into a meeting or Skype into a meeting, then that might be a solution as well. But again, you look at all the options when you're going through the interactive process.
So let's go back to the beginning when the request arrives at the employer's desk. How should an employer handle that initial request for a service animal?
Well, the simple answer is you handle it just like you would handle any other request for reasonable accommodation. So, you know, some of you will have received and dealt with requests for special chairs, lumbar support, special screens for computer monitors, special programs, anything that might be requested by an employee, you treat it the same as you would for that. So, you know, an employer certainly can and should require reasonable medical documentation from a healthcare provider to confirm in the first place, do we even have a disability here? Just because someone, you know, wants to have their dog or cat or snake at work doesn't mean that they're entitled by law unless they have a disability. So we basically want to, you know, receive and ask for medical support for the existence of a disability, just like you would in any other context, unless it's obvious and clear. And you can skip that step if it's clear the person has a disability. But, you know, otherwise you go through your normal process.
Any special procedures that you recommend?
Well, hopefully you all have forms, but just like any other reasonable accommodation request, the employee must engage in the interactive process to discuss the request, the parameters, the logistics, the feasibility of the proposed accommodation to see if there are other options. And, you know, it starts off by that, you know, request, and you an employer can and should have the employee use a form so that you're gathering the basic information you need to get that process started. What exactly the employee is asking for, get it in writing. Get the information you need, and then, you know, also ask for and get some type of healthcare provider certification or other certification about the employee's disability or impairment and limitations, and also about the animal and the training of the animal and what the animal is going to actually do or not do for the employee.
Can an employer set out ground rules for the animal, or is that completely up to the employee?
Well, luckily, yes, employers can definitely set ground rules. Employers have a right to ensure minimum standards for animals in the workplace, including requiring that the animal be free from offensive odors, that it display, you know, basic good habits appropriate for the work environment, that it is potty trained and relieves itself in the appropriate places and outside or whatever designated areas there are, that the animal, you know, not endanger the health or safety of anybody in the workplace, whether that be employees or customers or others. The employees certainly can and should be required to, you know, maintain control of and supervise the animal at all times. And David, you referenced, you know, a crate or kennel, you know, in some location. There are going to be times when, you know, the animal, you know, should be contained or put away if the employee is not going to be able to maintain that direct control over the animal. And, you know, nobody else, including supervisors or HR professionals, are, you know, going to be tasked with supervising or maintaining control over that animal. So all of that can be required and should be laid out, you know, in some type of agreement or understanding between the employee and the employer when, you know, when it's agreed that the animal can come to work and is coming as an accommodation and what tasks the animal is providing. But as long as the animal's not interfering with the performance of work or operations or others or offending anybody or, you know, causing you know, medical reactions or symptoms through allergies or otherwise of coworkers, then hopefully some type of game plan can be worked out to make it feasible.
So it sounds like you might recommend special forms that are unique to this type of accommodation, this accommodation by allowing a service animal. You have special forms for that?
Well, so I would say usually I recommend starting with your standard forms for requesting an accommodation so that at least you have in writing what the employee is asking for or thinks they're asking for. You could certainly, if you already know it's going to be a service animal request, you can retrofit or modify or add a couple questions to your basic form for an employee to request an accommodation. You're certainly going to need to either add questions or follow up with a healthcare provider, because most likely, in almost every case that I see or get involved with, there are going to be follow-up or specific questions that you need more answers on. You're not going to get answers or information or records regarding what task the dog is performing, what they're actually doing for the employee, what training the animal has, without asking very specific questions. So you can either do that up front if you know enough about what animal's being requested and why they're being requested. But sometimes I just let that first phase go through with your normal standard forms and then ask very fact-specific questions in response to that.
One of the things that we've done, just like we would for any other unique accommodation, is to draft something up that talks about what the expectations are. We're going to give you this accommodation, but here's what we expect with respect to doing this, implementing this accommodation, and with respect to having an animal in the workplace. There's lots of things that you've already mentioned that I think are good to put in writing and have the employee countersign on. Have you been seeing any lawsuits or charges of discrimination that specifically reference service animals as a reasonable accommodation in the workplace?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I mean, just in the last couple of years, it has completely mushroomed into a situation where, I mean, certainly on a weekly basis, I'm getting questions or calls from clients asking about how to handle an employee bringing in an animal to work or requesting that. And the EEOC itself has filed several lawsuits on behalf of employees who have requested service animals but were denied or partially denied that accommodation for their disability. I guess I'll turn it over to you, Dave, now. And are you seeing the same trend or increase in that context that we've seen in the employment context?
Absolutely. We continue to see this. I used the word exploding in the intro. I think it's the right word.
What do public accommodations have to provide as far as what types of animals are at issue there?
So keep in mind that most states have their own public accommodation law that's a function of state law. But under federal law, the only animals that are covered by the federal law that a public accommodation would be required to allow are dogs and miniature horses. That hasn't always been the case. There was an earlier time where it was the wild, wild west, like it is in the workplace now, where there were no limitations. It could be snakes or birds and so on. But since 2011, only dogs and miniature horses are protected service animals.
What about emotional support dogs or miniature horses, David? Are those required?
So technically, no, and the regulations that came out in 2010 and were effective in 2011 explicitly said that emotional support animals were not covered under federal law. And again, I want to emphasize we're talking about federal law here. But I do want to caution our listeners that sometimes there's a fine line between what we would think of as an emotional support animal and a dog that can perform a task, for example, like a dog that could perform a task of recognizing when an Iraq war vet is going to have a panic attack and come to that individual's aid by approaching the person and be available for petting or other calming activity. And so sometimes there can be a very fine line. It always strikes me as dangerous for a public accommodation to say, well, that's just an emotional support animal. I don't have to allow it in. Technically, you don't. but it's important to, if you're going to deny entrance to an animal, to make sure that you've asked the question about what tasks, if any, it can perform.
So, David, now what can a customer, guest, patron, patient, or client of a public accommodation be asked if they entering the premises with a service animal, a dog, or a miniature horse?
Yeah, I get these questions all the time from my clients who run stadiums, arenas, hotels, and other restaurants, places where there may be reason to maintain a facility and not have it filled with animals. But the regulators made it very clear that you can ask two questions and two questions only. And those are, first, is the dog a service animal that's required because of a disability? And second, what work or task has the dog been trained to perform?
Do service animals have to be wearing a special vest or harness or anything that identifies them as a service animal?
No, not at all. And once again, this is made explicitly clear. I will say in certain states, like in California, there are some requirements for animals in training. So an animal that's trained to be a service animal, if you're really a qualified and service animal, like a guide dog for the blind or a signal dog for the deaf, those are highly trained animals that go through very rigorous training over many months, which includes getting acclimated to being in public environments and ignoring all distractions and just being there to work on behalf of your disabled person. But no, in general, a service animal does not have to identify itself at all.
So you asked me about situations where an animal can be excluded from the workplace, different types of reasons. Are there similar situations in the public accommodation context when a dog or miniature horse should be excluded?
We have the same direct threat to the health or safety of others that comes into play here. We also have a situation where having the animal there might fundamentally alter the nature of the goods, services, or activities. And so it's used as an example. As a general matter, a service animal is allowed to accompany a person with a disability wherever the general public can go in that public accommodation. But for example, some swimming pools or spas have precluded service animals from entering them, and they cite to usually local ordinances that prohibit animals from entering the pool or the water. And so there are instances where you could claim a direct threat to the health or safety or a fundamental alteration that would keep the animal out. But again, the idea would be to do the least restrictive thing you need to do to protect the health or safety of others and not just outright exclude the animal.
So on that note, I mean, we could talk all day on these issues. It is something that's coming up more and more, you know, both in the employee-employer context and the public accommodation context. But I think we'll leave it there for now. Any other parting thoughts, David?
No, thanks, Jim. Glad to have this chance to talk to everyone.
All right. Well, good luck, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.